I am calling this meeting to order. This meeting is open to the public and we will be providing an opportunity for public comment at the end of the meeting. As a courtesy, we encourage participants to mute themselves when they are not speaking to reduce the background noise. One challenge, of course, with that is remembering to unmute yourself when you are speaking. Also, for board members, to help us capture information correctly, please state your name when making comments. Thank you. At this time, I would like to ask our board clerk, Susan Neves, to call roll to confirm attendance of all board members. Once Susan has called your name, please respond by verbally stating here or present to confirm your attendance.
Good morning. Chair Wade?
Yes. Here.
Vice Chair Neubauer?
Present.
Board Member Kinkley?
Here.
Board Member Case?
Present.
And I think that's all of them. Thank you, guys.
Okay. The next order of business is approval of our agenda for today. Is there a motion to approve today's agenda?
This is Scott Kinkley. I'll move to approve.
Mark Case, I'll second.
This is Mary. Oh.
Okay. Any discussion? All in favor of the motion to approve to approve today's agenda, please say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstentions? The motion carries. Next item is approval of the minutes for September 15, 2022. Is there a motion to approve the September 15, 2022 meeting minutes?
This is Mark Case. I'll move to approve the September 22 meeting minutes.
Is there a second?
This is Scott Kinkley. I will second that motion.
Any discussion? All in favor of the motion to approve the minutes, please say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
All right, that motion carries. We will now move on to old business, starting with Mark and Grace. And we're, just for information, we're on item 5 of on the agenda.
Yeah, thank you. Just wanted to provide everybody with an update from the NACARA meeting last October in Nashville. first of all, just at a high level, I personally found it extremely informative and very interesting coming from the industry side to be able to sit and experience that and meet with those folks and listen to what they had to say. One of the things I took away from it was from a regulator's perspective, it's not about a quote unquote gotcha moment. These regulators are understand and are very well aware of the importance that collectors play, the role that collectors play in our economy, and they are very willing to engage with industry. And they're willing to listen to the concerns of the industry. We as an industry just need to seek that out. So again, a very interesting perspective, just having the industry background and being able to sit through the conference. just to touch on several other items, there was a presentation by the FTC. They reported, and I'll send my notes to the board for everybody, but just kind of at a high level, they identified three categories, top categories of consumer complaints for the last year, which totaled more than 5.9 million. But the three biggest were complaints related to identity theft, imposter scams, and credit bureaus. Debt collection complaints made up 154,000 of the 5.9 million, which ranked number 7 on that list. Previously, collection had actually been number 1 between 2013 and 2017. They also touched on amendments to the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act, that became effective in December of 2022, having to do with information security protocols. Specifically, agencies must have written risk assessment and incident response plan, and then annual reporting of that to their internal boards. There was a presentation by the Secret Service, or a representative from that organization, who spoke about the rising crypto industry and the fraudulent activity within that industry. They said that roughly one out of every $4 of crypto is a scam, and there was $14 billion of stolen or fraudulent crypto activity in 2021. Ransomware is up 144% in 2021 over 2020. And the average payment made to the actors committing the ransomware was $541,000, which was up 78% over last year. There was some discussion about the NMLS, the National Multiple Listing Service that many states use for licensing. The common thread there was that most regulators are in favor of it because they can see where an agency is licensed all in one place. However, most agencies do not prefer it. Let's see. Moving on, there was a lot of discussion about Regulation F, and specifically required disclosures on a model validation notice, and as well as Article 3 issues were discussed. Specifically, some folks may be aware of the Spokio decision, where federal district courts, in order to have jurisdiction, a plaintiff must suffer a concrete injury. Without that, there's no jurisdiction for a federal court to adjudicate a case. In December of 2020 alone, there were five cases in the Seventh Circuit that were dismissed within a one-week period for a plaintiff having no injury in fact. And the court stated in these that mental anguish is not an injury in fact, excuse me. Where this all could go is a state-by-state battle, I guess, to see if each state has Article III equivalents in their state constitutions. And Congress can also elevate a statutory violation to a concrete injury, but they have not to date. There was also discussion regarding the model validation notice with respect to Regulation F. Finally, there was a presentation by the CFPB, a gentleman by the name of John McNamara, who I've actually known for years. He was, before joining the CFPB, he was on the industry side and worked for a company that provides a calling platform that many agencies use. So it was great to see John. But he pointed out several things, that the levels of consumer delinquency are rising again. Consolidation in the debt collection market is continuing. FDCPA cases, interestingly, are down, although there's a thought that maybe some consumer attorneys are moving out of federal court and filing in state court, where it's a little harder to track. And the reason for that may be some of the standing issues I just previously spoke of. Cases brought under the Telephone Consumer Protection Act, or the TCPA, are continuing to decline and have declined significantly since the Facebook decision a couple years ago, and that cases brought under the Fair Credit Reporting Act are continuing to increase. John touched on medical debt, which totals $88 billion annually, and that impacts roughly 43 million Americans. Most of those debt collection trade lines are under $500. And 58% of all third-party trade lines reported to credit reporting agencies are medical in some form, followed by telecommunications at 15%. So quite a big discrepancy there. The Bureau's priorities are focusing enforcement on repeat offenders and other major market actors, enhance transparency through guidance. And again, that was one of my main takeaways, was the transparency with a lot of these organizations that were presenting, and listening to and learning from the business community. As a result of Regulation F, the CFPB is going to be updating their exam procedures. And finally, post-pandemic trends. As I mentioned previously, there's been a lot of consolidation in the collection industry. Some agencies are selling, some are merging, some are simply shutting the doors. Part of the reason for this could be the increased regulatory pressure and the restrictions put in place by Regulation F, as well as rate cuts by creditors. So in other words, the commissions that agencies are earning are being continuously reduced by their creditor clients. So that has, you know, led to the consolidation within the industry. California is in the process of enacting their own licensing requirements, and they have, at the time of the meeting, there were 1,300 license applications, which were being processed at a very slow rate. And then again, we're starting to see some on-site exams beginning again post-pandemic, and they expect those to tick up, although the work from home component can limit some of that capacity. So again, I'll send my notes out on the conference, but appreciate the opportunity to have attended it and found it extremely informative. So thank you.
And this is Grace. I'll kind of give an update about the upcoming meeting. So this year, it's going to be September 18th to the 20th. And that's going to be in Denver, Colorado. We had a committee planning meeting yesterday, and there is kind of an ask this year of whatever board member goes. There's going to be a panel around our work from home rule change, and there's some other states too that have had that, and so there'll be people representatives from there also, but wanting to have whatever board member comes to participate in that panel regarding that rule change. But other than that, the Nashville, it was the first in person since the pandemic, and it was a success. It was great to see everybody in person. It was fun. Good time.
Okay. Thank you both for those comprehensive updates. Our next item on the agenda, item 6, is new business. And at the first meeting of every year, the Collection Agency Board elects a new vice chair for the following 12 months. We will need nominations and a vote for this position. So at this time, I will open the floor to call for nominations for vice chair.
This is Mary Neubauer. I'd like to nominate Scott Kingsley.
Okay. Any other nominations? All right. Hearing none. I guess first, before I proceed with the motion here, Scott, are you okay with that nomination?
Yeah, I'm fine with it. I'm not quite clear what the vice chair does exactly, but I'm certainly willing to serve as that.
Okay. Yeah, is anyone from board staff can give us a little bit more information on that particular position, the duties?
Yeah, absolutely. So with this board, as opposed to some of our others, the vice chair is a little bit of a different role, because our chair is an ex officio member designated by statute. But in the event something happened that Chair Wade wasn't able to attend the meeting, or for some reason maybe had a conflict, I doubt that would come up very often, but for some reason had a conflict, he would turn control of the meeting over to you as the vice chair to run the meeting in his place. We're also working on setting up monthly check-ins with our chairs and vice chairs just to keep the communication going. And I think that's going to be more important probably for this group that as opposed to some of our others, because you do only meet twice a year. So that just helps us as staff be aware of things that are going on that we need to be bringing back to the board and get that communication going outside of that once every 6 months. And also allows us to provide information and get a little bit more feedback from our chair and vice chair in between those meetings. So it just creates a little bit more communication with the board that way. And you would be participating in that.
Okay. Yeah, no, I'm fine serving in that role. I think I'm the longest serving board member and I've never been the vice chair. So sure, yes, to answer your question, Fred, yes, I'm willing to do that.
Okay. With that being said, is there a motion to nominate board member Kinkley as vice chair for the next 12 months?
I thought Mary made that motion.
Yeah, sorry, I thought I did. This is Mary Neubauer, motion to nominate. Thank you. Scott Kinkley.
Okay. All right. Is there a second?
I'll second the motion. This is Mark.
All right. Any further discussion? All in favor of the motion to nominate Mr. Kinkley as vice chair for the next 12 months, please say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
All right. And I don't hear any opposed or any abstentions. Thank you, Mr. Kinkley. Look forward to working with you as vice chair over the next year. Our next agenda item is the NACARA annual meeting that Grace referred to previously. Sydney and Grace, I'll let you all take this item.
So as Grace mentioned, the dates for the 2023 NACARA annual meeting will be September 18th through the 20th in Denver, Colorado. And I don't know if Grace has any additional updates that she wants to provide on the event itself. But for board staff, we're looking for who from the board or who the board would like to attend and then an alternate in case something happens, because we understand that that's a ways out and things come up. So an alternate that would go in case that delegates weren't able to attend.
And this is Grace. And I just want to, the only thing I would want to add and just to like make sure you guys are aware is that there is an ask that whoever does go to participate in that panel.
All right. Do we have anyone who would like to attend this conference?
I think I'm up with Dirk out. I think I was up anyway, and I'm willing to be on that panel. And I think that kind of makes some sense given, I think it was Mark and I who carried the load in drafting that from the board's perspective. And so I'd be willing to be on that panel, willing to go to Denver in the fall.
This is Mark. I'd be happy to be the backup. And I agree with Scott that since him and I were on the committee that drafted that, it would make the most sense.
Okay. Thank you. So we have, for the staff, we have Scott as the primary, Scott Kinkley as the primary, and Mark Case as the alternate. The next agenda item is regarding DOL's process to review consumer complaints, and this agenda item will be led by Sydney.
So I will start it off, but I will preface this by saying Grace is actually the brains behind this report. This was an item requested by board member Kinkley. Regarding the process for how case managers are assigned to cases. So from the report that was included in your packet, Grace did a great job of outlining the different scenarios that her team sees and how they go through assigning case managers. So under scenario one, when the department receives a complaint on behalf of the board, and reviews it, sees that there's no jurisdiction for that complaint, then the case is simply closed with no jurisdiction. Under scenario two, the complaint is within the board's statutory jurisdiction and an investigation is completed, but there may be insufficient evidence to move the case forward with a violation. And in that case, the board has delegated authority to DOL staff to administratively close cases on its behalf due to insufficient evidence of a violation. And then scenario three, when we would actually bring a case manager in, the complaint goes through the investigation. They do find that there is sufficient evidence to move forward for a possible violation, or there's a lot more complexity to the case that requires a case manager assignment, then staff will reach out to the case managers and complete the file review and go from there. The possible recommendations that are available with the case manager are to close the case without any further action, meaning they didn't find that there was a violation of law or rule, or didn't feel that there was sufficient evidence, then the board member can make that recommendation as well. To close the case with a letter of education, which is a more formal way of doing remedial counseling, providing information to a licensee that there was a violation and education on how to make the necessary changes. But by issuing that letter of education, it just formalizes that process and gives staff a way to more formally document that that communication occurred. And then if something happens that the same licensee has another complaint on the same thing, it gives staff a basis to reopen the case and potentially look at pursuing charges. Or the case manager can always recommend sanctions, and then it goes through the adjudicative process and with an order and moving forward to the board. Susan, if you want to go to the next page. So when it comes to assigning case managers, Grace and her team do look at a variety of factors, including workload. For example, if a particular case manager has a number of cases that they are already reviewing, we don't want to overload one case manager when there are others available who can review it. So we'll look at that. We do consider if there are any potential conflicts of interest. And then we also look at the expertise of a board member. So if a board member, for example, a public member is brand new, has no experience in the collection agency field or with collection agency law, they're more likely going to lack the expertise to review a case. And so that is more of a case-by-case basis on where that expertise is available on the board. And Grace also included the current case manager assignments as of a couple of weeks ago when she put this report together. I don't know if those numbers have changed, but it looks like Mr. Case has a couple hanging out there. There's one with Dirk that we are trying to close out, and one with Mr. Kinkley. And so I'm sure Grace has a whole lot more information that she can provide. But if the board has any questions, we'd be happy to answer.
Thank you, Sydney. I made that request in response to some public comments that we got at the last board meeting that was looking for some clarity in that process. And I think that this does a very good job of explaining that. Subsequent to that, I got a request, or I don't know if you want to call it a request, but a member of the public was concerned about the conflict screening process when assigning complaints to various board members. I was wondering if you could speak to that and how, if a complaint had come through, how particular board members and potential conflicts might be vetted.
This is Grace. I can take that. So when we get a case, like there's ones where I know for sure Mark can't have, you know, he represents this agency. That's a conflict. I know that. There's times when if you would get the case, say you, Scott, and then you would review it and say, oh, I have, I'm I'm doing something with this company, I probably shouldn't do that. Then that's just a communication that's sent back to me, and then it would just get reassigned. Also, there's the look at competitive nature of this happens a lot with funeral home in the funeral home, but it also happens with collection agencies. But if it's a collection agency that is in the same town as Mark's agency, and they're like a direct competitor, then you know, probably not assign that to him, you know, so jurisdictionally or, you know, geographically we look at that as well. But if any of you guys ever get a case where, you know, you think that maybe there's a conflict, it's just letting us know, and then we can reassign it, because we're not going to know every conflict that'll arise. So it's something that you guys would have to communicate back to us.
Excellent. Thank you, Grace. And Sydney.
And I also wanted to kind of touch a little bit on the letter of education option, because it's kind of a newer option for closing cases. It's become a little bit kind of popular with all the boards across the regulatory, what we have. And it's just a really good way of, you know, especially for first offend, you know, it's a first complaint that we got. It's, you know, to be able to educate and give that, try to help them get into compliance. And then if we see a pattern, like in the future, saying, oh, they're doing the same thing that we just educated them on, then we can reopen that case at that time and move forward with more like formal charges if we choose to. So just if you guys have any questions about that, let me know, because I know it is kind of a newer option. I don't think that we've gotten any for collection agencies. So if when you're reviewing it, you think maybe that's a good option, we can just have that communication. And then also the graph here with who has what's assigned to people. If this doesn't look at your like if you don't think that you have that, give me a call after the meeting and we can kind of figure out what's going on and if maybe something got missed somewhere.
Thank you.
And then looks like we've completed that agenda item. And so our next agenda item is number 7 regarding reports. And this conversation will also be led by Sydney.
Yeah. Susan, if I could get you go to the next one. So this is our administrative closures report. We have 3 cases that have been closed for no jurisdiction. 16 cases that were closed with no violation, 1 case that was recommended to be closed by the case manager, and 1 complaint that was withdrawn or opened in error. Through February 7th, our cases are broken down like this, very similar to the graph that Grace had concluded in her last report. We have 1 case that we are still trying to get back from board member Bunker, 2 cases from Mr. Kinkley, two cases from Mr. Case, and 1 from Mr. Kinkley. We also have several that the case status is closed, 17 that are currently under investigation have not been assigned to a case manager, for a total of 74 cases. And our licensee count is broken down like this. That is very small for me to try and read. Susan, can you zoom in on that a little bit? So out-of-state collection agencies, we have 686. Out-of-state collection agency branches, 686. Out-of-state collection agencies, 531. Collection agency branches, 262. And collection agencies, 274. And I will let Susan take the report on our action item list.
So we have scheduled charter committee meetings with Scott and Mark in progress, board delegation committee meetings with Fred and Mari, that is in progress.
And so with both of those, we will be working on reaching out to you over the next month and getting those committee meetings scheduled. Part of the delay with the charter committee has been working on getting everything. All nine of our boards have been working on charters independently, and they all kind of ended up taking their own life and getting into different formats, different orders. And so trying to bring some order back to the chaos that ensued across all nine, trying to get them all in one format and in one set of order, making sure they're consistent with all the information provided. So that's been the delay in getting that going, but we will make sure that comes back to you. And then with the delegations, we will be working on getting that committee together as well. There will be some slight changes that staff will be requesting with the delegations. And then just some internal staffing changes that are occurring with the department that the delegation committee will need to be working through. But we couldn't really take those on until those changes occurred. And so we also wanted to provide an update on some of the staffing changes. I feel like this board, probably more so than others, has been a little bit more removed from a lot of the changes that have occurred within Department of Licensing, especially within the Business and Professions Division. So just trying to provide an update on what we looked like before the functional alignment versus what we look like now, how those changes have occurred and how those impact the board and the collection agency program. So this is a breakdown of how the Business and Professions Division is structured post-functional alignment. Our assistant director, I apologize, I am tongue-tied today, is Jennifer Clausen. She is supported by our deputy assistant director, Sarah Pittman. Reporting directly to Ms. Clausen is our licensing and customer support services unit, who is currently headed by Vanessa Simpson, acting as their interim administrator. The centralized investigations and audit unit, which Grace represents, is headed by Catherine Nagley as their administrator. And the regulatory compliance UCC and firearms group also supports the board when we do have cases move forward for charges. That's the group that drafts those charges and works toward the agreed order, putting all of that paperwork together and in legal compliance to come before the board. Also reporting to them, but with no board impact, is the prorate and fuel tax group, who is headed by Lynn Briscoe. Under Ms. Pittman, we have central services, who is currently headed by our interim administrator, Catherine McDaniel. That is the group that handles all of our reporting. So the licensing reporting that we just went over, the case status reports, those are put together by that team behind the scenes. They also review all of our analytics and handle contracts management. I don't think we really have any contracts that impact this group, but if we did, this is the group that would support you. And then our team, which is the one you will interact with most, is board and outreach support services. And we have an interim administrator who took the place of Rick Storvik, and our interim administrator is Bill Dutra. Go to the next one. There we go. So this is a breakdown of what our unit looks like. You are seeing a whole lot of new faces, and we get that. So just wanted to provide you an updated list of who is now supporting you. Our unit is basically entirely new since last summer. So we apologize that you've seen so many new names and faces, and we really haven't had a chance to introduce you to everyone since then. So we do have a new program specialist 3 who took the place of Kim Hall, and that is Susan Nieves. And I know you've seen a lot of communications coming from her, and you will continue to see a lot of communications coming from her. But this is the first chance we've had to introduce you. She started with us October 16th last year, so this is her first time seeing all of you. And then myself as the program specialist five, together we handle all five of the regulatory boards. So architects, funeral and cemetery collection agencies, geologists, and landscape architects are all within our sphere. Our equal counterparts directly across from us handling the advisory side are Sandy Bauer and Sandra Schaefer. They handle cosmetology, real estate appraisers, real estate, and the home inspectors board. And then above us, we still have Deborah Allen Baugh as our assistant administrator, Mr. Dutra as our interim administrator, and Alyssa Woods, who you will sometimes see communications with, especially with upcoming travel, that will all be handled by our administrative assistant, Alyssa Woods. And so I won't go into a ton of detail on this particular slide. This is included in your packet, but it explains what the regulatory board unit looked like before the functional alignment and what it looks like now. But the main piece to drive home about that is with the functional alignment and the shifting across the different units, a lot of the faces that you'll see regularly have stayed the same, with the exception of the staffing changes that have occurred in our unit and board support. But Grace is still here with us. We still have our investigators. They're just housed outside of our unit now. And what that did was take the organizational chart that you see here, where you have, you know, 10 to 12 people who support the programs in different ways, and it broke them out into those different units. But with those folks now represent a much deeper bench, if you will, of people who are supporting each of the programs. So even though Grace is still going to be your primary point of contact on the investigation side, she has a whole team of investigators working with her now and additional resources that have opened up to her. Same thing with the board support. Even though Susan and I are the main faces that you guys will see, there's actually a team of seven people that all offer input, that we all come together and tackle all of the issues together. And so each of those units that I went over has that. So now the program pays for a small number of employees providing that direct support, but that represents a much larger number of positions and an even greater number of people supporting them behind that. So like I said, I'll let you guys dig into that, but I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have. All right. Well, with that, we will roll into our board training, and I will bust through this as quickly as I can, understanding that this subject matter is probably going to be very dry for most of you. I understand Open Public Meetings Act is probably not the most exciting thing you guys will hear about in your day, but we are required as staff to provide this training to the board once every 4 years. And with a different board, we actually received how this all came about, we received a public records request for copies of all of the training that had been provided to a particular board. And in particular with Open Public Meetings Act, there will be a document that we'll be sending out to all of you signing that you've received OPMA training and that you acknowledge and you'll abide by it. So Susan will be sending that after this meeting. But when we dug in and we're trying to find those for this other board, we realized we didn't have them. Not just that we didn't have current ones, we didn't have any of them. We don't know where they went. We don't know where they were stored. We didn't have them. So in an effort to make sure everybody is caught up and all on the same page and has received the training, we are going to go through Open Public Meetings Act. Parliamentary procedure was requested by several of our boards, so that is another one that we've built in today. Conflict of interest and ethics was another one that was requested, as well as public records disclosure and what and how that impacts you as a board member. So this will take about 15 minutes, but it's a lot easier for us to take 15 minutes of your time here when you guys are scheduled versus asking you guys to schedule an additional meeting, or as this was originally scheduled for about a year ago, was to ask all of you to come here to Olympia for this training with all of the other boards. So please feel free to stop me if you have any questions along the way. Otherwise, we are going to get through this as quickly and painlessly as possible. So the purpose of the Open Public Meetings Act is that the legislature finds and declares that all public commissions, boards, councils, committees, subcommittees, departments, divisions, offices, and all other public agencies of the state and any subdivision thereof exist to aid in the conduct of the people's business. It is the intent of this chapter that their actions be taken openly and that their deliberations also be conducted openly. The OPMA exists to maintain the people's sovereignty, to allow the people to delegate their authority while retaining their individual rights, to allow the people to retain control over the instruments that they have created, and for the public to keep informed about government operations and about how these functions impact them. The OPMA does apply to all meetings of a governing body of a public agency and shall be open to the public, and all persons shall be permitted to attend a meeting of a governing body of a public agency. A governing body is defined as a multi-member board, commission, committee, council, or other policy or rulemaking body of a public agency. This does also apply to committees thereof when the committee is acting on behalf of a governing body, conducting hearings, or taking testimony or public comment. A meeting is defined as simply a gathering where action takes place. It does not have to be titled a meeting in order to qualify. This also applies to retreats, workshops, study sessions. Changing the title doesn't change the fact that it can be a meeting. An action means the transaction of official business of a public agency or body and includes but is not limited to public testimony, deliberations, discussions, considerations, reviews, evaluations, and final actions. The requirements of OPMA are triggered whether or not an action is final. And final action is just the collective positive or negative decision or an actual vote by the majority of the members of a governing body or by its committee. Any actions must be taken in public, even if the deliberations were held in an executive session, and voting by secret ballot is not permitted. A quorum, the reason we take roll at the beginning of a meeting, is defined as the majority of the members of a public body. So as a 5-member board, our quorum number is 3. Vacancies do not reduce the number required to meet the quorum. So if we have a member resign or who has termed off, and their position sits vacant for a meeting, that does not drop our quorum number down to 2. It will stay 3. If there is not a quorum, then action cannot be taken at a meeting. So if for whatever reason we only have 2 members show up for a meeting, we can't take any action, or the board cannot take any action. And if there is a quorum present outside of a meeting, the gathering is automatically considered a meeting and is therefore subject to the OPMA. This happens even if you run into each other at Starbucks, which I know you guys are all spread across the state, but you never know. The format for a meeting does not have to take place in person, as the pandemic forced us to realize meetings can occur through telephone, email, online chat, or any other electronic media as well. An exchange of email could constitute a meeting if a quorum of the members participate in an email exchange or discuss board business. Simply receiving information without commenting is not considered a meeting, but please do not reply all when multiple members of the board are on that email, as that can become risky. So we ask that you use caution when emailing board members and at such exchanges or subsequent discussions among board members could ultimately rise to the level of board action. So a lot of times, if you have information that you want to share with the board, the safest course of action is to send that to myself or to Susan, and we can forward that to the board to make sure we're not creating a space where you guys could inadvertently cause an OPMA violation. Separate offline discussions between members without a quorum could also be considered a meeting if you're splintering the quorum. This occurs when two board members get together to discuss something that they have going on, or maybe something that they want to see put on the next board agenda, and say, you know what, that's a good idea. But then you leave the discussion, you're like, you know what, I think I'm going to get somebody else's opinion on that. If you both have that thought, you go to somebody else. And especially being a 5-member board, it only takes one additional member entering any chain of that conversation to cause a discussion among the quorum, and that becomes a violation very quickly. So we want to make sure you are aware of that. The reasons to avoid this are it deprives the public of its right to listen to the deliberations going on about a topic that may be presented before the public body, removes discussions and decisions from the public view, and ultimately undermines the public's confidence in the decision making of the board. Likewise, comments or side conversations that occur in a virtual meeting chat feature could also constitute a violation of the OPMA because members of the public may not be able to see or therefore witness them. They are not recorded or captured in the minutes or transcript of the meeting, and they are distracting to the orderly conduct of the board. We don't have a lot of issues with that with the collection agency board, especially being a smaller group, but we have had that occur on across several of our boards where discussions were happening in the chat and then board members were getting pulled into those discussions in the chat. But we have members who have called in who aren't, or public members who have called in who don't get to see that. If you call into the meeting, you're not seeing the chat. None of that is being recorded or captured. None of it's being relayed to the public. And if it takes that conversation into that chat that then is never brought back out into the public conversation, that's an OPMA violation. And so for that reason, you'll notice that for 2023, board staff has disabled the chat feature so that we eliminate the possibility of that OPMA violation happening. So a lot of times we'll get questions about why a meeting is titled as a regular meeting versus a special meeting when they're all regularly scheduled. That is actually defined by statute. A meeting only qualifies as a regular meeting if the date and time are set in statute or rule, and all other meetings have to be titled as a special meeting. So again, with regular meetings, the dates and times are established in the RCWs or the WACs, and a state public agency must file an annual schedule of regular meetings with the code revisor, must post public notices and post public notices on the agency's website at least 24 hours in advance, though we try to do at least 2 weeks. And we have to submit regular meeting schedule changes to the state register at least 20 days in advance. For special meetings, most of our board meetings are titled special meetings. Again, notice must be given at least 24 hours in advance, though we do try to shoot for at least 2 weeks. Special meetings must include proper notice of the date, time, location, and agenda. And notice is not required when these special meetings deal with an emergency. But when we're talking about an emergency, we're talking about things like act of God, weather damage, things like that. So most of that provision does not apply to our boards and commissions here. Meetings Meeting agendas must include not only notice of the date, time, and location, but the specific items that are going to be discussed, considered, or decided. If an item comes up that is not listed on the agenda, it cannot be discussed. It must be referred to the next meeting when it can be properly listed on the published agenda. Public comments are required by law for regular meetings, though we do include them on our special meetings as well. And a public body may impose a reasonable time limit. We usually do 3 minutes across all of our boards, but we have had instances recently where we had several members who turned up to talk about a particular item. And in that case, the board could ask or could impose what they feel to be a more reasonable time, cut that down to 2 minutes because of the number of comments that they'll be receiving. And comments from the public must pertain to matters within the board's jurisdiction. So somebody can't come to the collection agency board and complain about the funeral cemetery board. In response to public comments, the board may request that the matter be referred to the next agenda for discussion, can refer the matter to staff for research, can state that the comment is not within the board's jurisdiction, or can remain silent. You certainly don't have to respond at all. And the board may not engage in discussions or deliberations on the matter, cannot converse with the public member on the matter, and above all, cannot take action on the matter. And that is something we've seen across several of our boards, is that a lot of times members of the public will come to a board with customer service questions or different questions that they want the board to answer right then and there. And unfortunately, the OPMA does restrict what the board is able to do. And so in that case, it's best to ask that that be put on the next agenda so that the board can actually discuss it. For the minutes that you all approve, they must be promptly recorded and open for public inspection. They are not required for an executive session, and no format is specified in law. So in summary, the OPMA exists to ensure that the public's business is conducted openly. It applies to any meetings of a public body and its committees where deliberations and actions are occurring. It includes verbal or electronic communications among a quorum of the body. And the bottom line is always err on the side of caution and conduct business as openly and publicly as possible. I know I went through that very quickly, but are there any questions on the OPMA?
No questions from me. I had to turn off my camera because of the internet going up and down, so that's why my camera's off.
No worries. I know all too well how that goes. Okay, we will move on very quickly to parliamentary procedures. This is based on Robert's Rules of Order. And again, this was one that was requested by several of our boards, so we are including it for everyone. So what is parliamentary procedure? It is a set of rules for conduct of a meeting that allows everyone to be heard and make decisions without confusion. It is a time-tested method for conducting business at meetings and public gatherings, and it can be adapted to fit the needs of any organization. So this is our typical meeting order. It has changed slightly for all of our boards. We'll still have the roll call, call to order, roll call, approval of agenda, and approval of minutes that we've always had. Awards and recognition is a new item that will be added if applicable. So when we have a board member who has turned off, they've served, and we want to recognize their service, this is the point of the meeting where the board will have the opportunity to provide that recognition. And part of the reason for this is on one of our other boards, for most of our boards, this occurred later on in the meeting and was causing we had a board member who came for their recognition and had not received it 3 hours later when they got on a ferry and were in the middle of the sound where they lost cell service. So they didn't get to be present for their recognition because the meeting went long. So we decided it's probably best if we move that forward earlier in the meeting so that they can have their recognition. We can take those couple of moments to provide them with that. And then they can move on with their day and the board can move on with the rest of the business. Old business and new business, as we've had before. Reports is an area that we've really tried to consolidate. We used to have several different items broken out for reports. We tried consolidating that all into one heading for reports. Public comments will now come prior to the conclusion of the meeting. And that is because during the conclusion, the board will have an opportunity to request future agenda items. Previously, that occurred ahead of public comments and really didn't give the board any opportunity to then say, hey, we had this request from the public. Can we make sure that that's added to a future agenda? So this just creates a little bit more of that formality and creates that space for the board to add those. And then under the conclusion, we do have a couple of changes. So announcements are anything that a member of the board would like to announce to the group, that they've decided to resign from the board, that they are wanting to participate in a NACARA committee, that they're pursuing this thing that they wanted. It's also a great space where if you've attended other meetings that pertain to the industry, but not necessarily to the board work, you can provide a really brief report out during that announcements item. Then we do have the request for future agenda items and a review of the action items moving forward to the next meeting and then our adjournment. So the life of a motion is pretty simple. Someone makes a motion, someone seconds the motion, there's discussion, and then a vote. Motions are made by obtaining the floor. Please wait until the last speaker has finished and address the chair directly. It's a good practice to maybe raise your hand with the virtual hand that we have, or when you're in person down the line when we're able to return to hybrid meetings, raising your hand, getting the chair's attention. When you do make your motion, please speak clearly and concisely and always state your motion affirmatively. So say, I move that we, rather than I move that we do not. For example, I move that we deny rather than I move that we do not approve. That can, a lot of times when staff is working on the minutes or when the public is reading the minutes, I move that we do not approve sometimes gets confusing for the public, or if they're reading through it very quickly, that it's just, well, there was a motion to approve. It just creates that space for confusion. So we want to eliminate that as best as possible. Once you've made your motion, please wait for someone to second. If a second does not occur immediately, then the chair will ask for a second. Go to the next one, or is it frozen? There we go. If there is no second, then the motion is lost. When there is a second, the chair will state that it has been moved and approved that we, and that puts the motion before the membership. Motion can always be expanded on if during the discussion the group feels that the original motion did not fully encompass what the board wants to make that motion to be. It can always be expanded on. And then once all of that discussion has occurred, the chair will put the question to the membership asking if we are ready for a vote. Votes can occur most often by voice, but every once in a while you may see something called a roll call vote, and that's where staff reads the name of each individual member and has them vote yay or nay individually. Other commonly used motions are motion to table. Maybe the item isn't ready for final determination by the board, but it's gone through everything that the board can discuss at this particular point. Motion to table for consideration at a later date. Or there can always be a motion to postpone indefinitely if the board has worked on an issue and there's really just nowhere else it can go. You can't approve it, you can't deny it, you can't really do anything with it. Motion to approve or motion to postpone indefinitely just basically kills the item and removes it from the board's work. So in summary, parliamentary procedures are the best way to get things done in your meeting, but only if it is used properly. Only allow motions that are in order, have members obtain the floor properly, speak clearly and concisely, and obey the rules of debate. Most importantly, please be courteous. So are there any questions on parliamentary procedure? Okay. I believe our ethics is next. Yep. So general expectations that a board and commission member should not have a financial or other interest or engage in business or professional activities that conflict with the performance of their official duties. Use of state positions to secure special privileges or exemptions for themselves or any other person are not permitted. Receiving compensation from a source other than the state of Washington for the performance or non-performance of your official duties is not permitted. And receiving gifts that could reasonably be expected to influence you are also not permitted. Conflicts of interest involve the concept of benefit and bias. Questions to ask yourself when evaluating your potential conflict of interest are, will your interests benefit as a result of your official action? And would a reasonable person conclude that a private or personal interest impairs your independent and impartial judgment on the exercise of your official duties? Some conflicts of interest are very clearly defined, such as acquiring a benefit or financial interest in a contract or a transaction that is under your authority or supervision with the board or commission, or accepting compensation from someone else who has benefited from your action or inaction as a board member. Other types of conflict are not so obvious and are determined on a case-by-case basis. These include non-financial interests, personal or professional activities, and obligations that conflict with the performance of your official duties. Another instance is the use of your official position to secure or convey a special privilege or exemption for yourself or for another person. Because the board is under the state's jurisdiction, you may not accept gifts, or gratuities, or favor if the gift, gratuity, or favor could reasonably be expected to influence the performance or non-performance of your official duties, and the gift, gratuity, or favor could be considered part of a reward for action or inaction in the performance of your official duties. You can accept gifts if neither of the previous conditions are met. However, there are limitations. If you may accept a gift or gifts up to $50 in value per calendar year from one single source, or a single gift with a value of up to $50 from multiple sources. And gifts given to family members may also be subject to the $50 limit unless that family member has an independent family connection, professional association, or social relationship with the gift donor. The resolution for a conflict of interest relies on disclosure and recusal. If you have a private or personal interest that could benefit from your official actions or might bias your judgment, it's best to recuse yourself and abstain from participation in the discussion or voting on any matter that affects these interests. The state ethics law protects and permits the use of state resources and the conduct of official state business. Resources include equipment, office, and conference room space, vehicle supplies, postage, time, personnel, etc. Exceptions for this can be found in the WEC. Personal use of a de minimis amount of state resources occurs when there's little or no cost to the state. The use is brief. It occurs infrequently. Does not interfere with the performance of any state officer or employee's official duties, and does not compromise the security, or integrity of state property information systems or software. So something like, hey, can I grab a post-it from you? That's de minimis, not a conflict. Personal use is considered de minimis only if each of the following conditions are met. It is not for the purpose of conducting any outside business in furtherance of private employment or to realize a private financial gain, and is not for supporting, promoting the interests of, or soliciting for an outside organization or group. Some board members are privy to confidential information. If you have access to this confidential information, the information may not be disclosed unless provided for by law, and confidential information may not be used for personal benefit or for the benefit of others. So are there any questions? Okay. And our last one, public records disclosure. Again, this was another one that was requested by several of our boards. So why should boards and commissions care about public records? Isn't this the responsibility of DOL? Well, state agencies and boards are required to have available for public inspection and copying their records, such as procedural rules and statements of general policy and any other records, including written or electronic communications pertaining to board business. What's defined as a public record? Any writing that is prepared, owned, used, or retained by any state or local government agency and which contains information that relates to the conduct of government or the performance of any governmental or proprietary function. This does include traditional written hand note records, emails, audio recordings, including voicemails, text messages, photographs, and online content, including websites, social media content, tweets, etc. Not everything is disclosable. There are narrowly defined exemptions in the RCW and the WAC, including personally identifying information such as date of birth, social security number, driver's license number, residential address, etc. Financial information, including credit and debit card information, emergency contact information, and personal information about employees, appointees, and elected officials for whom disclosing would violate their right to privacy. So that is a question that we get a lot, especially when you guys first join the board. We have you fill out the information that allows us to pay you for your time on the board. There is some personally identifying information that you have to submit with that. All of that is non-disclosable, and in the event that those records were requested, would be heavily redacted. Same thing when you're traveling, if you need to submit for reimbursement, but it was on a credit card statement or a credit card receipt, any credit or debit card information would be redacted if those records ever happen to be requested. So what happens when board records are requested? Those requests are submitted to the Department of Licensing in writing. Staff coordinates the collection of the records. We do have a specialized department whose staff will contact everyone connected to the request and obtain their portion of the records. So that department will contact us as board staff if it involves a particular board member or somebody wants all of the board's emails, for example. They would ask us to reach out and coordinate with all of you. If there are any emails that you have that are disclosable, you would then provide them to us, and they would go through that review process. And then we do go through a review and fulfillment process that includes that specialized unit working with the legal team on anything that needs to be redacted, anything that legally cannot be disclosed or is not within the scope of the request, things like that. In the off chance you are contacted by the media, this doesn't happen very often across our boards, but it's not never. So we did want to include a little piece on this. So what to do if you are contacted by them? Communicate the request that has been submitted to you with board and commission staff so that we can help you coordinate with our communications team for input and tracking. Anticipate community interest, including industry and public events. and keep your focus on the business of the Board or Commission. What not to do is to share your personal opinion or express grievances, lobby for any particular legislative action, answer questions that you do not know the answer to or are not comfortable answering, or risk your personal integrity, the integrity of others, the integrity of the board, the integrity of your profession, or the integrity of DOL by making thoughtless or unwarranted remarks. So are there any questions on disclosure? All right. Well, I know that that was a lot to power through, but thank you for taking those additional few minutes. And again, we thought it was best to go through it here in a public meeting and take those few minutes rather than asking you to schedule an additional meeting.
Well, thank you, Sydney. And I can tell you that having been in law school classes for the past several months, that was the best lecture that I've had for a long time. So thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, so we'll now enter our public comment period. The public may address the board on matters within the board's jurisdiction, either verbally during the meeting or by submitting written comments. The board is limited to directing staff to study the matter further or requesting that the matter be rescheduled for discussion and consideration at a later time. Members of the public who address the board verbally are limited to 1 3-minute comment. In lieu of a verbal comment, individuals may submit their comment in writing at least 2 days prior to the meeting by emailing dolboards@dol.wa.gov. Written comments are limited to no more than 500 words and will be read by staff during this portion of the meeting. If someone who is on the phone would like to make a comment, please unmute your line, state your name, and share your comments with the board. As a reminder, please mute your line once you have finished. Is there anyone on the line who would like to make a comment?
This is Larry Kassoff, and I'd like to make a comment. I'll wait for you to start the timer. I did want to comment that we seem to be having an explosion of out-of-state collection agencies that are continuing to pick up clients in the state of Washington. And it appears to be at an epidemic level. When we see the City of Seattle's Municipal Court hiring an out-of-state collection agency to do the actions literally in the courthouse, it is a problem. They are not going to get prosecuted for their crime of exceeding their license. And it really is just really problematic. And I just wanted to make sure that the board was aware of it.
All right. Thank you, Larry. Is there anyone else who would like to make a comment? Hearing none, board staff, do we have any written public comments to be read by staff?
No, sir, we have not received any.
Okay, thank you. We now come to item 9 of the agenda. Do we have any announcements?
Hi, yeah, this is Mary Neubauer, and I would just like to let the board know that I have submitted my notice to resign my position. My term has ended, and I will not be seeking reappointment. So I just wanted to say thank you so much for the opportunity to serve with you all. It's been a wonderful experience, and yeah, thank you.
And thank you, Mary, for your service. Are there any other comments or announcements? I'm sorry. If not, then Susan, can you walk us through our next two items?
Does anybody have any requests for future agenda items? Okay, so I see that for the action items that I will be reaching out to the board members to schedule the committee meetings. And in the future, I will begin arranging approval for Scott Kinkley's travel for NACARA in September. And that's all I have. If anybody else has anything else they'd like to add. Looks like that's it. Thank you.
All right. Thank you all. This meeting is adjourned. The time is 11:15.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you.